Patrice, who co-founded IDEO.org with me, wrote a piece at one point called Turning Maslow's Hierarchy on Its Head. And so it was really about the importance of designing for delight, even when we were working in these really constrained environments. And so we think about and talk about that a lot, which is like, how do we make sure that we are designing for a feeling of empowerment or inclusion or community or love or beauty in these tough contexts?
Welcome to the IDEO.U Creative Confidence Podcast, a series focused on building your confidence at work to tackle your biggest creative challenges.
Join us as we learn insights and lessons straight from IDEO and today's most impact-oriented design thinking leaders.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard.
And I'm Kalita Stafford.
Hello. Welcome to the Creative Confidence Series. I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard, founder and dean of IDEO.U, and I'm here today with Jocelyn Wyatt, my special guest. Welcome, Jocelyn.
Thank you.
So Jocelyn is a fabulous person to talk about what it means to advance techniques in design thinking because she is the founder and CEO of IDEO.org, and that is an organization where we push forward the cause and good quality design for people in situations of poverty. That is clearly a place where you don't want to spend a lot of excess and fall off the progress because you really want to have a serious and important impact in people's lives. And so we thought it was a great space to have Jocelyn here to share some of the stories and techniques that they're using in IDEO.org. So we're glad to have you. But to start off, I know we wanted to hear from you about, we know there have been critiques of what it means to use something that sounds fancy, that sounds expensive, like design or design thinking in the space of people in social strife or dealing with situations of poverty. Yeah. So there's been a lot of critique and we're wondering where that conversation is for you today.
Yeah, I mean, when I started at IDEO, which was now 11 years ago, and started to introduce human-centered design or design thinking into the social sector, and especially into fields of global development or poverty alleviation more broadly, there was a lot of skepticism. It sounded like this fancy private sector thing, or that we were really designing things that would be sort of out of reach of people that were living in low-income communities in the U.S. and around the world. But I think over time, people have seen that there are really great outcomes that we're seeing, that we're actually able to reach the goals that we're all striving for, and able to see really significant things happen as a result of using design thinking in our practices around global development or around poverty alleviation.
And so that's really changing the conversation. What are some of the things? I know in IDEO.org you've put an incredible amount of effort into how to measure the impacts and tracking the impacts of your work. Can you give us some examples of the kinds of things you track?
Yeah, I mean, in the reproductive health work that we're doing, it's probably the clearest. We really kind of align a set of outcomes. And so those could be things like one of our programs, it was to increase the number of 15 to 19-year-olds who were using contraception and reach 200,000 new users of modern contraception in Ethiopia, Tanzania, and Nigeria. And so what we're doing is really tracking those outcomes along the way to see how many young women are taking up contraception that weren't using it before.
Wow. Those are some serious numbers. And definitely a space I know I personally care a lot about.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know we'll be hearing a lot of great stories.
Seems like we're on track with that one.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Wonderful. And I know that one of the things we wanted to start off with something a little more interactive with our audience, because I know we've got a lot of people in the community who are working hard to push the boundaries of the work that they do. And so a lot of people are practicing design thinking at a basic level, foundational level, and we certainly are believers that anybody can do this kind of work. So it's important to get out, build empathy, understand the insights, brainstorm, ideate, and prototype. But one of the things that we commonly hear from our community is that they're having trouble working with the powers that be or the stakeholders or the funders of their work, creating the space to do these kinds of things, especially we get questions around room to prototype and fail in order to succeed. And so I know you brought some things with you today to share. But before we do that, we're going to have a little interactive moment. So we want everyone out there to imagine that you are about to walk into a conversation where you're doing some work in healthcare in the developing world, and you know that you want to use prototyping and design thinking techniques. And you also have a clue that the people that you're working with might not be ready for it. They're starting to say things like, we can't afford to fail, or there's no room for failure in this process. And so you want to have a first conversation to set the stage to do this work a little more creatively, a little more differently. And so I know, Jocelyn, you've faced this a few times.
Absolutely. Yes. Many times.
Yeah. And so are you working with your teams to develop techniques to make this better?
Yeah, absolutely. We really focus on sort of getting to alignment in our kickoff meetings with our partners and our funders. And one of the tools that we found to be really helpful is a theory of change. And so what a theory of change allows us to do is to really start with a clear articulation of those common outcomes or goals. And so that could be things like the number of young women that are taking up modern contraception, for instance. So that conversation then leads us to a discussion around what are the different pathways or stakeholders? So how might we get there? So there could be a number of different ways that we could accomplish that goal, and we want to lay them all out and start to talk about which ones are sort of out of bounds or not feasible or viable, and which ones might be possibilities. And then with that, that really allows us to get to a much more refined design brief with some constraints that maybe we didn't previously understand. And there we can go off and really begin that research.
And so what I love about that is that so often when we kick off a piece of work or a program or a grant, there's a brief and it's all written and there are words there, sure. And everyone thinks you're aligned, but are you really?
Yeah.
So this allows you to kind of hold that conversation and really get alignment. It really comes to life for me when we share it through an example.
Sure.
I know you brought a great one that can kind of show that to us. So walk us through this project Ishtar, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is work that we did with Mercy Corps, working with Syrian refugees in Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan. And so here, what we knew was that the ultimate impact that we were trying to get to was improved reproductive health for girls and women in refugee camps, this being one of them. But, you know, that's a pretty lofty goal, and there are certainly many steps that need to happen in order to get there. So we sort of worked backwards to the inputs, and we basically said, okay, there are many different ways that we could get to ultimate impact goal, but we're going to really focus on puberty education. What we found was that younger girls, 10 to 15-year-olds, really just didn't have the language to talk about their body and didn't have enough knowledge about the changes that were going to happen or were happening with their bodies during puberty. And so in order for girls as they got older to feel more sort of ownership and connection to their bodies and really understand reproduction later, we needed to start off with understanding things like menstruation. We ultimately decided together with Mercy Corps to really focus on puberty education with these young girls.
So you're moving back from impact, outcomes, outputs, inputs, and like
yeah.
all the way down to the root causes of what might be missing or finding the right level to interact.
Exactly.
With
and
this
we
challenge.
Could have gone in a number of different ways, but I think working with them, we really said, like, okay, it just seems like this, working with the younger girls on puberty education, seems like a really good path to get there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So then we started to map out, like, okay, how are we going to reach these young girls? Like, where are they? So let's just sort of think about it like, okay, well, they're in school. We could reach them through teachers. We could reach them through their parents. We could reach them through their aunts or grandmothers or community health workers. We could reach them through their older sisters or through peers. And so we started to sort of imagine a set of different stakeholders that would surround these young girls and different pathways to reach them.
And so those are options, different
exactly.
vectors on which you can tackle this problem. You're not sure exactly which one's right just yet.
Right. So then we went to Jordan and we started to talk with a whole set of those different stakeholders and started to sort of understand who the girls saw information from, who did they trust, who in those groups actually did have a pretty good understanding around puberty and menstruation and reproduction, and then started to prototype with different stakeholders to see, you know, what might be most effective in terms of reaching these girls.
And so what I love about using this theory of change and moving from articulating goals to mapping pathways and stakeholders to refining the brief is that it kind of creates agreements around what the ultimate goal actually is. And then it liberates the team to try different techniques, to experiment a little bit more, and even have the space to fail as long as they're driving toward that longer goal.
That's right.
And so I wonder, so when you talk me through like a moment where you had something go awry and this liberated the team to have the right kind of conversation with the larger set of stakeholders.
Yeah. So everyone everyone told us that it was so important to engage mothers in these sessions and to have them really connected. Otherwise, they would get really concerned that, you know, Mercy Corps or others were kind of teaching their girls something that they didn't want them to be taught. So we started off by prototyping a session where we had the mothers join the young girls for a conversation and sort of a training or a workshop around puberty. And it didn't work very well. And the reason that it didn't work very well was that many of the mothers themselves had misconceptions about some of these topics. And so one mother just firmly asserted again and again in this session that her period was extended when she took a shower when she had her period. And so therefore, it was clear that no one should take a shower when they had their period, which is obviously not what we want to advocate for. And so despite what the trainers were trying to say and correct her in this, she just was certain that this was true. And so then that puts the girls in a tough position too. Do they trust their mother? Do they trust this outside person? And, you know, it's just this sort of awkward situation. So what we ended up doing, we actually found that older sisters were great educators for their younger sisters, and that we could train the older sisters to sort of be, to deliver this and actually to sort of teach these lessons through reading a storybook. So our team ended up writing a sort of short novel appropriate for 10 to 15-year-old girls. We actually modeled it off of Harry Potter as a way to sort of understand what kids really was engaging to them. And then at the same time, we designed a separate conversation that we would have with mothers. So the mothers could feel confident. They could really, they could read the book themselves. They could see what it was that we were teaching, but that could be done in a separate place from where the girls were actually engaging with their older sisters.
What's so cool about this whole framework and this technique is that you have a way that you can take preconceived notions or assumptions that everyone has for what might be right and insert them into the process as tests. Yeah. And experiments. And then even if some people on the team were thinking, oh, no, mothers couldn't possibly be in the conversations, you don't have to have an argument about that. You can just test it and get the feedback and see what happens. So that's great. Yeah. Wonderful. So thank you for that story. Yeah. I think we wanted to talk about a couple other examples. I know you have rich, rich stories to share with us today. And so one of the things that we know teams at IDEO.org are really amazingly skilled at is storytelling. And so that's such an important part of the advanced design thinking techniques, because so often we're doing things that are about innovations. Therefore, they can't be measured because they don't exist in the world yet. So we can't move forward with the comfort of data and proof around us. And so a lot of times we are catalyzing change through stories that we're trying to tell that really present the needs. And so I know you've brought another story with us today about doing just that in the space of financial well-being, right?
Yeah, that's right. So in this case, we were working in the context of the U.S. Our brief from J.P. Morgan Chase was to design a digital tool that would improve the financial health of low-income Americans. So over the course of this project, we had many different ideas, and ultimately we landed on an idea around a chatbot that would sort of do the follow-up from an individual's meeting with a financial coach. The chatbot would then sort of remind them and give them tips and tools on how to follow through with the plan that they put together with that coach. And so everybody sort of had their own vision of what this chatbot would look like or do or sound like. And it wasn't until one of our designers, Rafa, sort of over the course of a day, basically put together the story of Janice. And so Rafa just really sort of quickly in a presentation just showed us what happened from Janice's meeting with a financial coach to waking up the next day to getting the reminder from this chatbot to then accomplishing the task and then getting the sort of validation and celebration from doing that and getting the next test, et cetera. And so just with sort of a really simple story of an individual's experience with this chatbot, Rue, we, the whole team, was able to align around what it was that we were working towards. And we were also able to get our partners really excited about what that could look like, because suddenly this chatbot came to life and the way that it would actually impact someone's life was really evident.
Yeah. And so when you were talking about it before and you just say, oh, the chatbot does this, like what was happening in the conversation? Was it just that until the story of Janet came out and started to stitch it all together, what was stuck in the conversation with clients?
I think chatbots sounded really inhumane. Chatbot sounded like it was going to be like an automated text message, like you get the reminder from your dentist's office, right? That's what people were envisioning. And when we started to build out Rue as a character, and that we started to prototype a tone that was really conversational, and we started to build in sort of different nudges or behavioral triggers around celebration, then it became so much clearer to people, like, oh, this is actually a delightful experience, and I can understand why someone would want to engage in this, where someone might not want to engage in that sort of automatic appointment reminder.
Yeah. I think it's so important, especially in situations where we're dealing with nuances of the relationship and then automated forms of intelligence, where right now it's still hard for us to conceptualize how that's going to feel really human. And so storytelling is really important when we're dealing with these advanced technologies, from blockchain to AI.
Yeah.
So, I know another place that the teams at IDEO.org have really been pushing things is that it's so common for a team to get stuck, especially when you're dealing with extraordinarily complex circumstances, when you're dealing with lots of needs, whether it's spaces where it feels like you can't fail, whether it's healthcare or poverty or extreme circumstances of all kinds. And so what are some of the ways that you keep design present and the essence of something that's rich and human present when you're dealing with these complex circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, even we too sort of get overwhelmed at times and just don't really sort of remember that it is people and their experiences and that we're designing for, and that some really basic human needs really remain the same regardless of the situation that you're in.
Do you guys have like little mantras on the IDEO.org team that you're like, remember the people or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about actually Patrice, who co-founded IDEO.org with me, wrote a piece at one point called Turning Maslow's Hierarchy on Its Head. And so it was really about the importance of designing for delight, even when we were working in these really constrained environments. And so we think about and talk about that a lot, which is like, how do we make sure that we are designing for a feeling of empowerment or inclusion or community or love or beauty in these tough contexts?
Then I think we're just in a place in the modern world where services are more well designed, no matter where you sit in the globe or in the economy. And so people are used to these services having a higher quality to them, and they expect that from the government or the public sector or healthcare. So I know you did some work in another refugee community exactly around this. And I think it's a really great story to share, because I know the team got a little bit stuck themselves.
So. Yeah, so basically the brief that we got from our partners, American Refugee Committee, was to design a tool that would allow us to capture customer satisfaction at different service delivery points from refugees in the camps that they were serving in, you know, around the world. And so we started off in Nakivale in Uganda. And, you know, the first phase of this project, the team went in and they just saw such a constrained environment. And they sort of had the brief, which was really focused on the design of this technology. And so they ultimately designed a tool that would allow the refugees to express whether they were satisfied or dissatisfied with the water that they were getting in a particular morning. What we found is that, you know, they were leaving the tablet sort of on these stands at these water delivery points, and they were just not getting very high response rates. And it was sort of hard to know what was happening. So we kind of left them there and let the prototype run. And we were all kind of like, it seems like this solution isn't really working that well. So we then started a second phase of work and sort of said, like, okay, are there different ways to kind of think about this? And a different team went back to Uganda and really started with a question of like, okay, let's put the technology on the side for a moment. And let's actually think about what we're trying to do is to improve customer service and service delivery. How do we actually focus on the service element of that? So they ended up training a team of refugees to basically go out and engage with community members at those water points and really ask them, like, are you satisfied with this service? And what are suggestions that you have for improvement? They also created this really fun brand called Kucha Kucha, which, you know, the logo is this smiley face. It's this bright yellow color. They gave them all these really bright yellow t-shirts. They designed this big yellow book, which had all of the different values. Their slogan was the shortest distance between two people is a smile. And so they really sort of got this team mobilized under this brand and mobilized to really be agents of customer service. They also worked with them to sort of develop a set of rituals. And my favorite is that before they head out, they start every day with a morning meeting and they read some pages of the big yellow book. And then before they go out to connect with the refugees, they each look at themselves in the mirror, give themselves a big smile, and then walk out the door. And so that just sort of gets them sort of in that mindset of being these really friendly ambassadors who are then, you know, carrying these tablets and using technology to gather this feedback. But the face of Kucha Kucha is now the person and not the tablet.
Yeah. And I think what's so amazing about that is that you think so much where teams will get locked up in what they're trying to do and how they're trying to impact people. And that prevents them from thinking about things like delight, like beauty, like joy in a situation like this. And so it's a lot of times you'll see that the aesthetics are drab and mundane instead of full of pleasure and happiness, which is a way to flip the nature of the problem. So I think that's such a beautiful example. And I love knowing that everybody gets stuck at some point. Every team does. And so how do you not go into a downward death spiral in that moment, but find something that can flip it around? And so I think so often it's thinking about something that you can bring together with it or mash up with it, that it's a high-end customer service to draw things back out to the experience you truly want to create in
that's
the world.
Right.
Yeah. That's lovely. So wonderful stories. But I know we had one more story.
Yeah.
So one of the things I remember about when you first came to IDEO and you were doing lots of work, you came in as a business designer. You'd done so much work in Kenya in healthcare and also in India working with Vision Spring. And you were really helping to push the boundaries as a business designer of the ways that we moved forward and used prototypes, not just to prove out a product or a service, but actually that an entire business could be scalable and sustainable. And I think that's been a technique, those techniques, some of us call them live prototypes, have been something that's really pushing practice across design thinking and IDEO in general.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to have you share one more example today of a series of prototypes so that we can help people understand how people who are more advanced in their techniques really scale these things up over time.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a project that we did with PSI around increasing usage of modern contraception amongst Ethiopian women. So here what we started off with was to try and figure out, okay, where are we going to find these women that are in need of contraception who, you know, if we were to reach them, it would make a really big difference. So Ethiopia is a primarily rural country. So we realized that reaching rural women was really the priority. They were the ones that really didn't have access to contraception. When we then looked at rural women between 15 and 19 years old, the majority of them were married. And so we said, okay, so we're going to focus our efforts here on married rural women. So with that, we sort of started with the first question was, should we reach women directly alone, or should we reach women with their husbands together? And so the first round of prototypes that we ran were just to sort of put out invitations to come and engage in conversations around contraception, either addressed to women or to the couple. And we found that by far the response rate was much higher when we sent those invitations to the couple.
Interesting. Yeah.
So we then said, okay, let's proceed with designing something that would engage a couple. So then again, we sort of designed a number of different prototypes. And here we're really working through, you know, what we might call fixers. So these are, in this case, we were working with some young Ethiopian women, and they were the ones that were really running these prototypes because we, you know, as outsiders and people that don't speak the language would not really be able to effectively test these
prototypes. And how many fixers were you working through at this point?
At the beginning, just like two of them generally.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Really small. And again, we're testing these prototypes with a really small set of people at this point.
So how many people might you test with in the very first run of things?
I mean, at this point, let's say that we're working on an early prototyping trip and we're in Ethiopia for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. We're probably testing with, you know, 3 people a day or so, debriefing at the end of the day, revving those prototypes that night to introduce a new set of prototypes the next day. Okay. So it's really small. It's really small sample set at this point. So we then started to introduce, you know, what are different ways that we could engage a couple in a discussion around family planning. And so we talked about health and we talked about education. And the one that really resonated was financial planning. So the men in particular were really interested in talking about money and their finances. And so when we could frame a conversation around contraception leading to being able to determine the number of children that you have and the spacing of those children, the men suddenly really perked up and were interested in talking about how they could actually plan in that way.
So that was a comfortable way to start the conversation when you're dealing with a couple in rural Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So then what we had to figure out was like, okay, how do we equate sort of children and money and make this a really clear equation for people? So we started off thinking the way that we would, which is like, okay, a child costs X number of dollars or, you know, equate that into currency. And because these were rural families and they never really sort of saved in cash or money, that just didn't really resonate. So large sums of currency were not something that people could really understand. So then we said, like, okay, what are the ways that they do save or what are the big purchases that they make? So then we started to represent the cost of children compared to large bags of grain or goats. And when we were able to do that, people really got it. And so, again, you know, we're testing at this point with really small numbers. But really what that allowed is that coming out of that prototyping trip, we were able to put together this really visual training program that was sort of a set of flip charts, essentially, that health workers would go out and teach and then sort of end up in this conversation around contraception for the young women.
And then talk about how you scaled up the level. So if you started off with like very tiny sketches and 2 fixtures going out, 3 people a day for a couple of days in a row, then what was the next kind of level?
Then it was
scale?
Like we had, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 of these health workers that PSI trained that were going out each, you know, covering a couple different communities. And that maybe ran for another month or so. So there we're starting to get some data and then sort of go back to Ethiopia, do another round of refinement based on that feedback that we're getting. Then we maybe moved to a place where we had, you know, 20 or 30 of these people that were trained up in 2 different regions in Ethiopia. Again, sort of that ran then for another 6 months or so. So that was really what we would call the live prototype at sort of a larger scale. So then, you know, we're looking at the data and we're also getting the feedback from the people that we're running this. We, you know, return and sort of observe how it's going ourselves, do another round of refinement. And then most recently, PSI has trained up about 600 community health workers with the Ministry of Health of Ethiopia. And now those 600 are going out across the country to be able to deliver this to, you know, 100,000 people or something. So it's really sort of that step increase from really early prototype to live prototype to pilot to ultimate implementation scale.
Wow. Wonderful. Well, I hope that helps people to get a sense of how these things scale up. One question that I can see people are asking is about the space of time in between these series. And I know that's never regular, but is there any average or kind of a ballpark that you're looking at in between sessions?
I mean, we were really fortunate with this program in Ethiopia to have about 18 months from sort of initial kickoff through that sort of refined pilot test. That's a lot longer than we're used to having. I would say that we're generally able to get to kind of the launch of a live prototype with some early results on that by, you know, 10 or 12 weeks. And then oftentimes we'll let the live prototype run for at least a month and then would want to do at least a couple weeks of refinement. So, I mean, I think we're looking at, you know, 3 or 4 months kind of at a minimum. That's working pretty quickly. And with a team of people that's really focused just on this, which I know that most people don't have the luxury of doing either. Yeah. But when we are looking to get to something that is scaled up through the government and reaching, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in this new, pretty complex service delivery model combined with behavior change, like that takes years, really.
Yeah. And so sometimes you might be inserted at different points. It might be the earlier stages. It might be the later stages. It's rare to have something that's end to end.
Exactly.
How do you make sure that you're working with the right problem?
Yeah. I mean, this is a great question. And I think part of it is that we really, you know, I think we have the opportunity to choose the partners that we work with at IDEO.org. And so we really like to work with organizations that have been doing this work for years. So Mercy Corps, I mentioned earlier, PSI, these organizations have been working for decades. And we really trust that the teams, their country teams, know what those problems are in those places because they're working most closely on the ground. So we really, you know, we rely on our partners and sort of their trust in them and then work to really sort of understand those problems with them.
Do you ever have moments where a couple of questions that you tend to ask clients or partners in the earlier stages to kind of feel around the challenge and get a sense of how they're framing it or are they focused on the right things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, generally, our partners will come to us with a set of different questions. Mm-hmm. And some of those questions will be, you know, we recognize that there are so many assumptions baked into them. Yeah. And we start to try and pull those back a bit. And again, I mean, this is where we use that theory of change framework that we showed earlier, which is that we really start with, like, what are the outcomes that we're trying to reach? And then frame a how might we question around those outcomes. And so when we try and frame a how might we question, which is sort of before we align on those outcomes, we find that oftentimes it is sort of full of these assumptions of what the right direction is. And so, you know, I mentioned one earlier, which was the, you know, how might we use digital tools to increase the financial health of low-income Americans? Actually, I'm not sure that that was the right question. We did work with that question for a long time, but why digital tools, right? I mean, that sort of had an assumption baked in it. At that point, our partner was really convinced that what they wanted was a digital tool because they believed that it was scalable and because they wanted to build their digital capabilities. But was that actually the right question to be asking? Probably not.
For the outcomes that you wanted.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's nice. How do you know you have enough research to move to the prototyping stage? Are you ever worried that you haven't considered something?
Yeah. We ask this a lot. I think what we say, I mean, what I always learned at IDEO, and I think, you know, from you and others, Suze, is, you know, at a certain point, you start hearing the same things. Yeah. And that's the point in which you say, like, okay, I think we've got this. And it's hard to know exactly when that is, but you sort of know it when you see it. And so I think for us, you know, we really try to make sure that we're narrowing the set of people that we're really focusing on enough so that if we only have a couple weeks to do research, we're able to really get a sense of those people. So if we go back to the case of the Mercy Corps case with the young girls, for instance, we really had to focus in on 10 to 15-year-old girls. Because if we were to look at all women of all ages, like, we wouldn't be able to actually understand enough in this really different context if we had such a large population set that we were trying to reach. And so I think that's where, again, it's so important to narrow earlier on, because we don't have all the time in the world, and we do, we are sort of limited in the number of conversations that we can have. And then we're able to find those patterns if we're able to talk to a lot of girls between 10 to 15 years old.
Well, and I think another thing that you so naturally show in the stories that you're sharing with us today is that once you start prototyping, it doesn't, I think, so often think about prototypes as tests to validate that we're on the right path versus evaluating, is this the right path? And so I love when you share the examples that you're testing out different options, and the whole point is to learn, okay, not that one. And so if you think about the prototyping as part of the learning, it flips it around, and you don't have to worry so much about, do I have everything I need in order to move to the next stage?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we use prototypes as a tool for research, too. And so there, you know, we're certainly bringing prototypes into those first research conversations because they do help us learn.
Yeah. How do you take into account pre-existing resources, environments, experts in the design and prototyping process? So working around obstacles versus capitalizing on local resources and knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, this is where, again, we partner really closely with the organizations on the ground that we're working with. We really use them to help us navigate what those systems are. We do really use a lot of tools around systems mapping and systems thinking in order to sort of build out our understanding of what that context is and who those players are. And so, you know, one of the things that's been so important for us to do is to design solutions within these local contexts or systems. And so that means, you know, in the case of Ethiopia, understanding who was reaching rural Ethiopian families with healthcare and recognizing that that was the government, the Ministry of Health, through a community health worker network that they had. And that if we were going to design a solution that scaled in Ethiopia, it had to be delivered through the government.
Yeah.
And so when that was the case, then we knew that we needed to design a super simple solution that a community health worker could deliver, because if not, it wasn't going to go forward, or it wasn't going to go forward at the scale that we needed it to. So, I mean, that's really what we work to understand so early on, so that we're designing for whoever it is that's ultimately going to be delivering or scaling up the solution.
Yeah. So you might be focused and having constraints around where you're going deep, but you're mapping out the larger ecosystem so you understand what it needs to to lean into.
Yeah.
How do you establish trust with the community that you're working with? And I know that's something you and I are both extraordinarily passionate about, is not coming in from the outside world and telling people what to do. But what are some of the techniques that your team does to build trust?
Yeah, I mean, I think a few things. One is that we're always working with local partners. And so those local partners have the trust of the communities that they've been working in. And they're the ones that introduce us to people. They're the ones oftentimes that are the face of the interview, and we're sort of taking a backseat. They're the ones running the prototypes, and we're kind of sitting on the sidelines. I would also say that, you know, we have design researchers that are really trained in techniques around being able to engage sort of in cross-cultural boundaries through the conversations that they have. We also, on the IDEO.org team, we really work to hire people that are from the places where we're working or speak the languages, whether that's French or Spanish or Arabic. Or
you've just opened a new office.
Yeah, and then, I was going to say, we also just opened a new office in Nairobi. We were doing so much work in East Africa. There's such great creative talent in Nairobi, and so we said, let's actually work to build a team of Kenyan or East African designers who can really do this work much closer to their own context. And so I think that's really another thing that we're looking at with IDEO.org, is how do we start to see ourselves be a much more global organization with teams of people in different places who really come from and better understand the challenges that we're designing
for. Yeah, so important. So all these different techniques, from like having good people on the ground who may not be from that culture, but who are very thoughtful about building trust and engaging and opening up conversations, all the way through to working with and hiring people and partnering in local communities.
Exactly.
What's your favorite way to keep up the good momentum after an ideation or prototyping workshop or session, especially with clients that have slower processes, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you keep the urgency going and move things forward when it might be a bureaucratic mess behind the scenes?
Yeah. One of the tools that we found really effective in this case is a prototyping scorecard. So when we're asking our partners to prototype things that we might be creating or revving on, we actually have them, we've sort of already taught them how to run these prototypes, but then we give them these scorecards and we give them deadlines through when to submit these scorecards back to us. And the scorecards allows us to understand how those prototypes have gone and what might need to shift. And so we found that if we're sort of put together a project plan with them with these deadlines, and then we're giving them the tools that they're sort of required to complete and come back to us and check in with us about, that generally helps keep things on track.
Uh-huh. And so when you're doing this, you're thinking about the impacts, you're thinking about the measures. Your team might not be the ones doing this
work,
but it's a way to keep that thoughtfulness about measures and impacts going, even when you might be back at the home base and the partners are running everything.
That's right. And then we'll have calls with them to sort of hear how things went, and then we'll make suggestions for how to evolve those prototypes in order to address some of the challenges that they saw with them.
Okay, fascinating. And then how do you stay in touch, and how do you get those long-term impact metrics even after the phase of work that IDEO.org might have gone deep on is long over?
Yeah, so this is really about building much sort of longer term relationships with those partners. We do have a director of impact on our team, and one of the things that she does is, you know, working with our partnerships people, reach out to the organizations that we've worked with 3 or 4 times a year to sort of get those updated outcome metrics and then put them together in a dashboard that we keep up to date and we share with our board and with our team and others. And so, you know, that's been really important for us. One of the things that we've started doing is actually build into the agreements or the contracts that we have with those partners that they need to report those outcomes to us on a regular basis for a certain period of time, because we are only able to sort of raise the funding and have the credibility to do the work that we're doing if we're able to really report on those outcomes. So it's so important that we get those. And so it's really sort of reinforcing the necessity of that with our partners. At the same time, not trying to make them do extra work for our reporting requirements. So we really want to take the things that they're already reporting to their donors and then be able to use that for us to be able to understand what's happened.
So they're already the KPIs that are needed.
Exactly.
You might as well just make sure that there's one more closed loop to share them back. And that's, I think that's something that I've seen that IDEO.org and the organizations that you partner with are really pushing for, the face of social impact design by having these complete stories and allowing more people to do this kind of work. Well, thank you so much. I know we're all here at IDEO because we want to help increase growth and change in the world through innovation and design. And if you've been inspired by any of the things we've been talking about and the amazing stories of what it means to be a little more advanced in design thinking techniques with Jocelyn today, we do have an advanced design thinking certificate. You can go and gather information about that on our website, because we are quite inspired to help create more people in the world who have the creative confidence to go out and tackle these sorts of challenges. So thanks for joining us, and we will be back soon. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Creative Confidence from IDEO-U. Stay up to date on our creative confidence conversations and send your questions for our upcoming guests. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, and sign up for our IDEO-U newsletter at IDEOU.com/CC. Thanks for joining us.